Good evening and welcome to the April 2024 edition of Poet Radio. It's National Poetry Month, and I do hope there are deserving poets out there getting gigs and students who are getting more exposure to the wild and varied craft known as poetry because of it. This April on Poet Radio, I'm sitting with Ted Pearson, WGXC's Hudson Studio, and we're about to throw the spotlight on and talk about Ted's work. Ted is, by my count, author of nearly 30 books of poetry, beginning with The Grit in 1979.
Six.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Thanks for the correction. Fellow old Berkeley poet H.D. Moe is into correctionism, so I'm good with being corrected.
I haven't heard H.D.'s name in a minute.
Yeah, yeah. I loved him so much.
Yeah.
R.I.P., sadly.
Yes, yes.
Ted's most recent volume is Overtures, published in 2023. He is associated with the language poets and Bay Area, but has resided in a number of locations in the U.S. during the past three decades and is now living in Northampton. I've known and admired Ted's work since we met in Providence in 1991, and I'm grateful that he has come over today to be on the program. Welcome, Ted. I'm glad we've been able to reconnect, and we're doing this.
Indeed, it's a pleasure. Good to see you, Chris.
Likewise. How is the East Coast treating you?
So far, so good. The winters are a chore, but otherwise fine.
It was a pretty mild winter in the end this year.
That's what people say.
But not for...
not for West Coasters.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. But
wasn't snowy, but it was really cold.
Yeah. Well, I know you prepared a delicious set of poems to read, and maybe we should launch right into the poetry to begin orienting listeners who may be new to your work.
Okay, sure. I thought we might start with an excerpt from a poem called The Markov Chain. That's a book, one of my books, and it is part of a larger project called Analog Dreams. So, this is the... This is the first movement of the Markov chain. Early autumn blueprints a new theogony. Transcendental wasps build nests of pure duration. Neighborly aporia serve topical drinks. The streets are abuzz with seasonal aperçu. From dead beat debutantes, songs of ruination, gritty murmurations that spell the end of days. In the province of wounds, we anticipate scars, though the years between lovers were spent on belay. We know of your cravings for granular data. You must trust your reptilian brain for relief. It's clear that you've had some synaptic misgivings. Would a beautiful corpse offer grounds for belief? A bitter wind takes on the shape of a trumpet. Mute sorrow advocates for organized sound. Even as the house lights dim, footlights frame the stage. A choir of angels enters, singing tears of rage. A terror of typos and dismal enclosures, alike trouble morphemes and free-range composers. Where the punctum encrypts the site of transgression, the studium backlights a tale of repression. An aging magus searches for billable schemes. He's grown weary of waking from cringeworthy dreams. He cohabits with angels. They're far from extinct. But the angel's hometown isn't where you might think. Very few centaurs survived their narration, and those few balk at their new destination. Be it said they're in sight of a classical text, where the sun god in orchestral majesty rests. We were deaf to the cries that urged flight upon us, and blind to the deaths they repeatedly promised, but we do know the fate of those once put to rout in the midst of defending this crumbling redoubt. These formal restrictions are like benedictions. Forgive our enchantment, but we did go their bail. Constraints lead to freedom, exceeding predictions. The taint of the mirror is where all poses fail. By sunset, we've itemized all our part objects. We return to our cells when the chapel bell rings. At one with the dark, we embrace our seclusion and think through the night on the thingness of things. Short days lit by distant sun bring us little cheer. Now it's time to walk away from yet another year. As the season attests while approaching its doom, more than time may be lost when life loses its bloom. We demand compensation for our state-sponsored fears. We want back all the lives that have slipped through the cracks. Though the best teachers taught us to play things by ear, what we hear must be more than a symptom of lack. As wildflowers balk at extravagant vases, the subtlest of blossoms want sunlight, not glazes. In our search for a gesture as good as its word, we discovered a meme that denotes the absurd.
Constraints lead to freedom. Yeah.
Amen.
Huzzah. I mean, you know, not everyone would see things that way, but, you know, it can be pretty liberating to the voice, to the page, you know, because, you know, a few less decisions, things like that. So,
yeah,
I want to ask
these are Alexandrines, by the way. The entire book is written in Alexandrines, which is the French equivalent of iambic pentameter, but it's two syllables longer. It's 12 syllable lines.
Oh, all right. I'm not even sure I'm familiar with that form.
It's a 12-syllable, 6-beat line as opposed to the 10-syllable, 5-beat line of Shakespeare.
Who is Alexandrine?
The Alexandrine, I guess, is named for Alexander the Great. I don't know.
Yeah, yeah.
I truly don't know.
That's cool.
Alexandrine, but that's what it's called. But to us, it's a 12-syllable, 6-beat line, so...
Interesting. Yeah. Obviously there is a form to it, and I was trying to think of how that. I mean, you're identified with language poets, although I will admit that I don't always think of you in that context. But it does that poem doesn't seem so languagey. I did want to ask you about the Markov chain in general, the project, and how. That, I mean, that's Markov chains is generally, I think it stems from, the phrase stems from computer programming. How did it come to play in your creative process, the composition process?
Well, the options available in very broad terms are kind of, one can work by chance, the way John Cage often did, which... I find very attractive, but not where my heart lies. I'm much more enamored of contingency. And contingency seems to me the one constant besides death and the speed of light, I guess, you know.
Yeah.
So, we might give folks a definition of a Markov chain, so that explains what it is.
All right.
Which I can do briefly, actually.
Oh, yeah. Great.
A Markov chain or Markov process is a stochastic model describing a sequence of possible events in which the probability of each event depends only on the state attained in the previous event. Or we might say, what happens next depends only on what's happening now. So it's used in probabilistics, which is high-end math for everything from the gaming industry to the space program to, if you're Jackson Maclow, you can actually make gorgeous poetry out of stochastic events.
Yep.
Which was another, I mentioned chance, so another modality is that Jackson used was aleatory, which is not quite chance, but it invites chance into probabilistic measures. So we have a good chance of something happening until chance intervenes and it doesn't happen. So we pay homage to chance for that intervention, without relying on it ever showing up.
It's like chance with constraints.
Yeah, yeah, more like that.
Well, it's dice, right? Alia being dice.
Alia's dice, yeah. Exactly, yeah. My roots are in improvisation, and so for me, initial drafts are always acts of improvisation. But I'm post free jazz, so I like structured improvisation. You know, it's like the 70s proved more fruitful for me ultimately than the 60s in that one regard.
All right.
And that's with all the love in the world for Albert Ayler. So,
but you know, maybe you gravitate more toward Ornette.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, to stretch that almost metaphor.
Sure. Yeah. No, I mean, he's a solid Texas blues man.
Hmm. Well, thanks. I, and if you don't mind, could you give an example? I mean, if it, one thing, what happens next, depending on what happens now, how does that function in the actual writing?
I think it leads in improvising. Given a word, I follow that word where it leads, and it leads to more words, and I follow where they lead, and like that. So it's a matter of sticking with the words, fidelity to the words as they occur to me, to my mind, and like, I write them down, you know. I don't know yet where they're going. I don't know yet exactly what I'm thinking about at the moment. I don't know exactly where the image repertoire is going to come from, any of that. But it appears gradually, you know, as the words come. Mm-hmm. And eventually there's a usually very rough, embarrassingly rough, humiliatingly rough draft. And I spend a lot of time retooling and refining and revising and sometimes even introducing further stricter constraints to give it more formal being.
But it seems like you're keeping within certain themes and motifs within each of the poems, or... you're following a
within the serial poem itself, like within the Markov chain as a whole. Yes,
right.
Okay,
right.
But there's tremendous variation from poem to poem within the series. The little poems that make up the series,
right?
Which is all I write. I write relatively small poems in relatively long series.
Well, if it whatever works.
Yeah, I mean, right. It works for me. So.
Well, thanks for bringing those over. I was curious to hear them, and I was surprised that you stuck with. I mean, now that I know about the Alexandrine, that makes a little more sense.
A little more sense.
Otherwise, it was like, you know, rhyming and whatnot.
I actually followed this up with a book that opens with a poem for Barry Watton, an old friend of mine, which is in pure iambic pentameter all the way through.
All right.
I thought, you know, like, well, who better than Barry for that? So,
I don't know. I don't know. Great, Ted. Well, are any of the other works that you're reading today part of the Analog Dreams or no?
No, they're part of actually different, longer...
Right,
works.
Different pieces.
Different pieces.
Because that kind of got my attention, too. Analog Dreams, huh? I mean, I suppose... One day soon we'll be having digital dreams, but
I suppose,
what other kind
I
of?
I haven't yet.
right. What is an analog dream, yeah, besides a dream?
Yeah.
Very nice. Okay. What's next?
What's next? Okay, I thought we'd go to. This is the last of four serial poems that are collected in a book called Early Autumn, which, after much delay, is supposed to be appearing this year from Jack's Press. And this runs a little bit longer than the first one we heard. And begins, it's called Ghost Tones. Musicians and music lovers out there will know that ghost notes are notes that in a sequence of notes, the musician actually doesn't play that note, but it's in a series of notes around it, and you hear that note, even though it's not being played. And it's called a ghost tone or a ghost note. So that seemed like an interesting metaphor to work with for a series. And I love the epigraph I chose, which is from Ed Roberson, a wonderful poet. A future doesn't make sense without some place to be a present. Rise and shine, lizard brain. There are stories yet to be told. While big data quantifies the next extinction, Hieratic Hermes, half in the bag, hovers over higher ground. We laughed at the comic's cryptic asides and applauded the stripper's hips. Then came the diva pregnant with song, whose stylings held us all night long. If mating with angels offends propriety, which angels? Whose propriety? Where Eros pleads the need to know, the maestro's wisdom feeds your head. Play your axe, don't grind it, all that need be said. Let gaps in logic form arenas of pleasure, where lonely hearts mount the genital stage. Sex in a vacuum is no joke. To weep through the night is a sign of depression. Then it's time for another toke. Lest young Parsifal exhaust his brief, we've paired dumb luck with circular reasoning. This we do to advance his quest to uncover the origins of romance in the West. Language and thought are as long-lost siblings who have strayed from the matrix of surds. They'll never regain the time that's passed, but they're eager to share a word. So affix yourself to a term of art that you want thereby to diminish. Thus inflected, place that term before an empty mirror. Note that the mirror remains empty. Have a lovely day. To finesse the system is to sleep its bonds, to step out lightly and keep on stepping. It's only later they discover you've gone, and without ever leaving your chair. Chemical concoctions fill blank slates. Side effects conjure an impatient past. Redactions mask kinetic phrases. Each next flashback overwrites the last. Stable identities require known coordinates. Fluid identities are harder to trace. They'll never share the exact same space, nor, if they could, would they want to. What least fraction of a dying world do we yet dare to inhabit? Only those who remain could say, provided you can keep them on task. But since you need a place to stay, it wouldn't hurt to ask. Starting over is never easy, that much less with age. Premonitions of future losses vie with the news of the day. Estranged? Yes, I suppose we are, only now and more frequently abandoned. Storms of the century are annual affairs. Mountainous waves deliver our fate. A populace wallows in a sea of despair while madmen scuttle the ship of state. Nostalgia led to media buys to promote these romanceros, belief in which has got us where we spent our youth on wine and roses. Darker times want darker fare. Before the rebels reached the gates, the heiress had fled with the band. Investment-grade pearls marked a rite of passage. Two studs flanked a single strand. Pressed by fate, you remain undaunted. Your explanations weren't half bad. You never missed what you never wanted, so why regret what you've never had? He was half a heartbeat away from gone when her music caught his ear. The pain of loss underwrote each song. Sea level rose by the depth of a tear. One day, the scent of lemongrass and spices stopped him in his tracks. He thought of friends who went to war and never made it back. Memories flared like airbursts, only to fade to black. The art of decay is historically sound. Human structures are bound to fail. Where you once sought shelter, only ruins remain. The door to the real is the end of the trail. Dystopic days keep getting stranger. but only those who have danced with the storm will know to avoid its path. Knowledge as such is not without danger, neither is life in its aftermath. When they imposed a curfew at sunset, we looked to regain our cool. A spoonful of ease in the crook of an arm says it's better to nod out than die like a fool. They raised a ruckus at the ruckus factory, passing out pronouns to subjects in need. Then, after dodging the grammar police, they brought our call signs up to speed. Silence follows in the wake of decibels. Harmony offers its curative wares. Bold atonalities seek transcendence. A contralto's aria bespeaks her despair. Erotic dreams bring mixed emotions. Unrequited lust brings romance to its knees. The catechist warned us against ourselves, but the Sisters of Mercy were eager to please. Building consensus is like stacking marbles. The hook is service to a common end. But some would critique such coercive means, and those we call our friends. Whatever agency we have left is vastly oversold. The so-called social safety net has left us in the cold. Within our hearing, the silence is telling, as is our desire to be told. Prophecies assume that someone is listening, hence they fall on deafened ears. When outcomes betray your expectations, sorrow tempers your hopes and fears. Prized quilts served as roadmaps to freedom. Sermons depicted sinners as saints. When confinement equals prior restraint, flight is more than a metaphor within these carceral states. Carnal knowledge threatens norms that would limit our use and enjoyment. I remember thinking when I was young that sex had made me clairvoyant. This is one place that won't go sideways. It's a matter of age and it doesn't end well. You can make some history or ride the mystery. Visions depict what words foretell. It's less a matter of fear than fate that best defines the moment. Such are the terms of life on the street, and an imminent threat to life subsumes all further thoughts of peace. It isn't wise to catch a wave you aren't prepared to ride. That's when nature shows its teeth. The aftermath will hurt your pride, and then you hit the reef. Building consensus is like stacking marbles. The hook is service to a common end, but some would critique such coercive ends and those we call our friends. In a film about life on the margins, the future was never in doubt. When the end time comes, we'll stay for the credits till the ushers throw us out. Wakey, wakey, lizard brain, you've been thinking again in your sleep. The unconscious is said to resemble a language, but yours recalls the abyssal deep. All identities are eventually mistaken. Eternal hunger seeks a fix, and though it's never you in the mirror, even your failure to be here now beats life as yourself in the sticks. In the end, there's a kind of innocence at stake. More and more, we play by ear. Of the past, we kept only what we needed, and we can't reach the future we wanted from here.
That is incredibly well crafted, Ted.
Thank you.
And, you know, you were talking before about how, you know, that starts off as a chaotic mess. Well, it didn't really end that way. I mean, dark, but not a mess.
Yeah.
And what what is the form you're working with?
Oh, in this case, these are tiny three-line paragraphs. Each poem is a three-line paragraph. they're little prose, little tiny prose poems.
But there seems to be rhyme and...
There is internal rhyme, yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Just that you've imposed. There's no meter?
There's no meter. No, it's what the Greek called pousse logos, the irrational foot. Whenever the classic Greek poets ran into a problem with a strict meter, they wrote in modalities, right? Mm-hmm. They would have recourse to what they called the pousse logos. They would introduce an irrational foot that fixed everything. And to me, that seemed like like a good idea to just turn that into a meter.
Yeah, yeah.
Just the irrational foot itself. And then rhyme it, you know, because language poets aren't supposed to rhyme.
Exactly.
No.
But that's interesting.
Yeah.
I mean, it gives, and when you begin to hear unexpected rhymes, you realize the function that rhymes can, the purpose they serve is to, you know, sort of, it's like a hook, you know, and you go back to it and it sounds good. You know, you begin to judge the quality of the rhyme and
exactly.
The selection of the word. It's a type of constraint, right?
Rhyme is a constraint, it's a misleading one. The hardest thing to do is to rhyme on the exact word.
Hmm.
Rhyme should feel inevitable but not predictable. And that's very hard to do consistently.
Especially since you hear so many predictable rhymes, you know, anytime you're turning on the radio.
Exactly, yeah. Yeah.
And that's how it goes. And even if you turn on ChatGPT, you're going to get the expected rhyme.
Of course, so. In fact, in spades, yeah, absolutely. You'll get it constantly.
ChatGPT seems to think that poetry is only about rhyming, last I looked into it.
Right, so. And kind of really kludgy, stiff cadences.
Awful.
Yes.
Terrible.
Yes. Not a fan of AI.
Yeah, well, understandably so. I did want to ask you about the lizard brain and because you, in the first poem, I think you said something about reptilian mind, and mm-hmm. in this one we have the lizard brain. And when I was reading those poems, or that poem, the ghost tones, I was trying to figure out if the address was elsewhere or internal. I mean,
it's kind of internal. Yeah. I mean, it's, I go through these periods where I'm pretty far back in my head and words are not really accessible to me.
Hmm.
And so
that's unusual.
So I have to wake myself up psychically and come back to whatever level words exist on so I can proceed. But it's usually when I'm looking for a word that I get lost. You know, I go down the rabbit hole and it's like going searching back and back and back and back into my mind for whatever word I'm looking for.
Mm-hmm.
And when it's not forthcoming, I just sort of feel like I'm back in my reptilian brain, basking in the sun, saying absolutely nothing. You know?
I mean, before we all developed,
speech.
You know? Yeah,
yeah.
Right. That's
language.
Cool. Language.
Before language, it was raining.
And it just was raining.
Yeah,
that was all just raining.
That's all there was.
WTF, you know, like... Well, fantastic to hear the poems, and a great surprise to hear these, you know, structures that you're working with in a good way. You know, it's almost foreign these days.
It is
to have that kind of, you know, to impose those structures. I mean, there are people who do it very stealthily
mm-hmm.
with internal rhymes and stuff, but you're it's on the sleeve here.
Oh yeah, no, I'm hanging it out there.
And the other thing is, and anyone who's not actually looking at the page wouldn't be able to say it, but there's an interesting combination of like something that looks like a poetic stanza and then these blocks of prose,
mm-hmm.
But the prose are still poetry.
It's, sure. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's just another form. I don't make a distinction between prose and poetry. I make a distinction between prose and verse because there are two ways of establishing a line. One's a sentence and one's not. The more I've been able to teach myself how to write prose over the years, the more flexibility I've found in it than I used to find. So if all goes well, the prose should now be almost as flexible as the verse lines in terms of rhythmic play and variation and sonic play and sonic variation.
Yeah, why not?
Yeah.
I mean, it's
why not?
There's always talk of differences between horizontal and vertical language, but in the end, we're talking about language.
Yeah.
And it depends on, like, the composer, really.
Yes.
To how, I mean, maybe the way rhyme developed in poetry at the end, you know, words at the end of the line, that's like a artificial. Is it?
Sure.
I mean, it's just as much as, you know, the way that you're, you know, putting them all in there.
Sure.
It's interesting.
Absolutely.
Now, do you do that because you just, you don't want to do the same thing again and again? What brings someone who writes poetry to then all of a sudden transform? Maybe it's that contingency thing you were talking about earlier, you know, to give yourself different types of outlets.
I've always loved prose poetry. I mean, Baudelaire was an early influence in my teens, and I loved his stuff. And I tried valiantly, but not to my satisfaction. So it just never worked for me. I've always had mixed issues, feelings around prose that are just kind of subjective and based on traumas in graduate school.
Oh yeah, that kind of thing. I get it.
Where I was told, you don't write like us.
Well, who wants to write like you?
And who wants to be you when they grow up, you know, so... But anyway, the more pertinent reason is that I was just finishing the first complete draft of An Intermittent Music, which is a single work in four movements that took 36 years to write.
Wow.
And I was just finishing up what would be the next to last draft of that, so I'd have a few years to revise it after that. And Barry Watton called, and said that they were starting up this project called The Grand Piano, and would I like to be on board? And I said, well, sure. You know, as it happens, I've just finished this thing, and I'm looking for a substantial project, so let's... Sure, happy, thank you. So for the next 5 years, I was writing, for me, a lot of prose, which is like two essays a year for 5 years.
All right.
The publication plan. I mean, it took a couple of years at the end longer to get the last issue out. It was really a big issue.
Oh, you're talking about The Grand Piano?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, that's something else.
Yeah. But we made it happen. We got all 10 volumes done.
Crazy.
And it was crazy. But to do that, I had to get up to speed writing different kinds of prose.
Right. Right.
Some expository, some autobiographical, some critical, but all prose. And so I spent 5 years doing that and writing very little poetry, but doing that. And when I came out of it, I felt suddenly empowered to write prose poetry.
I would never have thought this before, and didn't think of it before, and I don't know how I would have, but this other Bay Area poet who did great prose poetry, Richard Brautigan.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I mean, maybe not quite as sophisticated as what you're doing, but he went between poems writing that looked like poetry in some of his books, and then like Watermelon Sugar and things that are totally prose but are crazy poetic.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, and I love Richard's work. I loved his work.
You did? I was afraid I shouldn't bring this up.
No. When I was a kid, I just, you know, loved
reading. Oh, that's
reading,
good to hear.
Reading and rereading.
But somehow it's gone way out of fashion. Not that I want to talk about Brautigan, because I haven't been thinking about it until this idea of poetry and prose and like a very lyrical prose style. I mean,
and where that particular idea for a lyrical prose came is from my favorite work of poetics, which was written in 200 AD by a guy named Lu Qi, Chinese scholar and poet, which in Chinese is called Wen Fu, which means the art of poetry or the art of writing. And it's the first work on poetics in Chinese history. And every Chinese poet from 300 AD to the present has studied it. We have three or four good translations of it.
Hmm. Good.
Yeah.
I have to look into that.
Yeah, and it's a wonderful book. And he wrote it all in rhymed prose, was my point.
Oh my gosh.
You know, nothing new under the sun. But some things we forget about or we don't make the connection right away. Like you're reading the foreword to the book, and it says, and these were written in rhymed prose. And you go, oh, that's nice. And then you keep, you know, I mean, and then, excuse me, and then one day I stopped and said, wait a minute, rhymed prose.
Yeah. You know,
like take that seriously. Don't just blow it off. Little light bulb, yeah.
Very good. What's next?
I thought I'd read one of the 12 serial poems from a book called Set Pieces. And I'm just going to read actually the first six of its 12 poems in this particular piece. But you'll get the idea of it. Mm-hmm. Each of the first six of those 12 serial poems was each subjected to a different constraint. So half of it, the first six poems, were written according to that constraint. And the next six, the second half of that poem, were written as a variation on that initial improvisation. Hmm. And that's repeated 12 times over 12 different content streams. And that's the book. So this is the opening of the whole thing, which is called Down and Across. Introvert life is benchmarked by defeats. The odds on beating the house are nil. It's hard to survive your expectations when language affords you no shelter to speak of. Right angles mock your perpetual drift. Miracles speak to your sense of the absurd. The culture police have closed the borders. Who will mourn the wild child's fate? We have come to the end of another era. Alexa, use meretricious in a sentence. While the search goes on for your lost libido, your memory essays your reckless past. Lust isn't love, but it has its charms, as lovers attest in each other's arms. What can't be named will not be tamed. The oracles agree, it's all in your head. Twilight finds you lost in the pharmacon. Let's count the ways to hit bottom. Your morning labors leave you spent, but surely the tide comes in twice a day. Obvious to remark, we are mostly water. Childhood's mandate was sink or swim. Let there be no talk of resurrection. Each next poem may be your last. The pass completes your formal education. You have wrapped your troubles in dreams. The sanctuary opens on a stairway to the stars. From there, it's only seven steps to heaven. As the last in a series of historical asides, nothing comes of standing by your word. The current regime has silenced your song with anthems of blood and soil. By factors so vast you seek an abridgment, the city of ciphers explodes into view. Then you descend and resume your life among people incapable of contact. With the casual grace of a practiced dancer, you tender your mercies and your resignation. Once you've gathered your bushel of doubt, to be quit with offers a kind of consolation. In a life spent milking blood from a stone, your blind side faces wherever you turn. When totality beckons, fangs and all, you barely escape the big picture. Chalk it up to a bad case of nerves. You live in the shadow of the sum of your parts. But as long as the grail remains at large, its legend will secure your existence. Subjects flow from the subject factory. Desire spirals from disaster to disaster. Where life exacts a succession of failures, reality appears as a kind of delirium. Evidence of thought is missing in action. Chronic fantasies supplant your dreams. fantasies of place, in which you have one, fantasies of time, in which you survive. Exiled, you pass through uncharted waters. At sunset, you turn your back on the sea. Sleep evades you, but not these voices, which linger like uninvited guests. The object is. Now, what objects aren't? Do we write just to fill these pages? Other voices tell other lies. Finding yourself at a loss for words should come as no surprise. Dead silence greeted your latest recital. Heartbreak followed you into the street. When heavy weather approached the city, rolling thunder wasn't far behind. Imaginary lightning illumines your path as if you were not and are not alone. The object in question speaks for itself. You speak at peril if you speak at all.
I'm not sure what the listeners out there will think, but I kept expecting to hear the rhyme, Ted. What happened?
Yeah, that was kind of a setup, wasn't it?
It's all right. But, you know, and you tease some like internally type rhymes in there, but you know, it's like, okay, now Ted Pearson is a rhyming poet.
I don't rhyme all the time.
No, oh, perfectly fine. I mean that was.
In fact, most of my work doesn't rhyme, actually, right. So, as you know.
That's interesting. But, you know, you kind of, the thing you throw in here, and not that it wasn't in the others to a degree as well, is there's humor.
There's more humor in this, yeah. A little more.
That's okay. That's good.
That's fine.
That's
good. Yeah,
I think poetry, you know, I value poetry that has humor built in. You know, I don't expect things to be funny or dressed serious things, you know, comically or anything like that. But when you can get in like some stealth humor, really,
it's a joy
for the reader.
Yeah,
I mean, maybe for the writer too, because it's kind of, you know, you're bordering on this idea. It's like kind of can be clever, but you want more than clever.
Yeah,
you want something downright.
You know, who's great at that is Jeff Young.
Yeah.
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 I mean,
we just were all together.
Yeah, I know.
Out there, and they have a great performer too. Really.
Yeah.
Really can roll.
Yeah, he's wonderful.
Another guy who. You know, music, to whom music is so important, I think. Are you going to still be reading the Null Set? Is that the...
Yeah, I was going to finish up.
So, and that's from a series called An Intermittent Music.
Exactly.
So maybe they'll use this as a way into talking about music just a little bit.
Sure.
You know, because, so much of your work has both subtle and like direct references to music and musicians and musical concepts. Mm-hmm. And I know you studied music, but I'm not so I'm not sure how much you're still involved with music, playing music.
Only as a listener. I started studying music in 1960. And it was primarily medieval music, vocal music, that captured me. And at the school I was going to at the time, there was one of the nuns had her master's in music and was into medieval liturgy. So it was just natural to study with her, and it was wonderful. And then that led to 2 years later, I picked up clarinet. And a year after that, saxophone, and then flute, and I was a working musician for about 10 years, from about the age of 15 till 24, I think. And then I stopped forever, because you can't do poetry full-time and do music full-time and work full-time and have a relationship full-time.
Yeah, you can't do it all full-time. But
and sleep, where's the sleep?
Wasn't, you know, in a way, it's good to have people who are very passionate about music don't necessarily have to play it.
No, right? No, absolutely not. And some of the most wonderful. I mean, I think of a really good critic like Terry Gross's husband,
Francis Davis,
who's just a superb. Thank you, Sheila. who's just a superb jazz critic. He's a beautiful writer, and very straightforward. He gets right to what is engaging him, and articulates it just beautifully. You know, so that's all very doable. And I don't believe Francis plays, but he sure plays his typewriter.
Well, I remember hearing Nate Mackey talking about his, you know, very short-lived musical career.
With his tenor sax,
and,
yes.
That guy.
I remember.
That guy, I mean, as a critic and a poet and a novelist, that what is that if not?
Yeah, making music.
Yeah, it's great.
It's great.
So this, you've held on to this passion, and it plays a role in your work for sure.
Well, a lot of what I learned as a musician, and I had good teachers. You know, I was one of Lee Konitz's first students. For very young people out there, he's an alto sax player that Charlie Parker loved very much because he was the only one in the world who didn't try to play like Charlie. Wonderful sax man. Anyway, he had just started teaching, and he was in the Bay Area for a time. And so I studied with him for a little bit and learned some very important things about playing music, of course, but they were applicable across platforms, I guess you could say.
Yeah, yeah.
Certain things were, one of which was word to word. In Lee's case, it was note to note decision making. You were liable to get something thrown at your head if you played a riff. Uh-huh. In his presence. He hated riffs, and he hated riff-playing musicians. He wanted you to think about every note you played. Of course, he could do it at 280 beats a minute, and I could not, but that's the difference between musicians and fans.
But what about projective verse and music? What about projective music? I mean, this is the totally...
I don't know. It's a good question. I'm not a projective verse person.
No. But that idea that you were just referring to is one thing leading to the
next,
other.
Yeah, right.
Sort of seemed like a...
Which is the definition, by the way, of melody. One thing leads to another makes a melody. And that could be words, that could be musical notes, it could be pieces of sculpture.
A corporeal, mental, intellectual... I don't know, sensual thing, as well as rather than taking on form, expressive form.
Right.
Probably.
Right. I think so.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Don't you?
Yeah. I know. I'm just coming to this, this idea, you know, just popped in my head right now and during our conversation to put some more thought into that. But let's, we're getting semi towards the end here. So why don't we, you have at least one more piece?
Okay, sure. Yeah. I thought I would end with a serial work called Null Set. It's the last of the 18 serial poems that make up an intermittent music, which I mentioned earlier was a long, multi-decade project. It finally appeared, I completed it in 2010. It appeared in 2016 from Chax. So this is called Null Set. And it bears an epigraph from Jacques Derrida. The book is often described as a tomb. In the cloistered light of a winter sun, the elements speak of things undone. While a singularity or ill-starred die is cast in futurity, elsewhere than art. Unable to recall the other it is and cannot know itself to be. Thus, that forgetfulness that is the human, that defines itself in extremity. Tired of appearance and disappearance, the caesura marks what might be otherwise estranging and estranged between tropes whose mitered edges mock the Pyrrhic muthos of presence that was lost from the start and played no part in whatever art might claim it. Beyond knowledge and the reach of eyes, The horizon retreats to untold revels, while an aging exile empties his pockets before the walls of the visible city, where a bevy of mathemes, attendant shades, and a corpus of glacial derivatives confirm his departure is his bequest. Unlikely as it seems, the years carry over to burden the topos that we call home, to which we address these psalms of negation, in which we encrypt these remnants and revenants, all that remains of our mother tongue, at home in no man's land. Not the embrace, but the encounter is decisive, where the word and the wordless arise as from death and meet to invoke a topology of being whose form is a form of love made plain by what spirits are or say they are when hauntology recapitulates phonology. Difficult as ever to speak of paradise or the errant angel of the supplement, that curve of breast, those canted hips, whose contours in their stark relief delineate our days, such are the signs of a dispossession we endure as in an anguish of mortality and take as emblems to our wounds. The narrative founders on mythic scarps, Utis, the cognomen of an ontic rift, where uncanny blossoms run a gauntlet of air and open the living past to risk, not least the risk of that disaster wherein the memory of what will have been proscribes any present occurrence to memory. As above, so below. Even in hell, the dead keep busy, given that thought is no longer thought of death, nor death the death of thought. And we who traffic with the dead breathe their words as if our own, and lend to them a living tongue to tell and to remind ourselves of what we've left undone. Hmm. A little madness goes a long way, though every step be a further step into madness. And to know this, whatever it is to know this in advance, in light of which we find what is as it is impedes what might be otherwise, unless we retreat from madness. Breath equivocates where once it praised a tradition that lives on borrowed time. The figure at issue in the nexus of art is the continuity of song made strange, which is not nothing, but for that nothing it would fill in making whatever remains to be made there in its name. The wind in the wires is also song, of which no words survive, as what was written must now be written over and over in the archive of an image that is not a song, but a cipher addressed to the many we are, that more shall be.
It seemed like a place so full of a particular gravity that we just have to end there. You know what I mean? It was like, even if your voice came to like this, I don't know, almost like conclusive point. And wow.
That's muscle or tonal memory from having first written that poem at the end of 36 years of working my way towards that poem.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, then, yeah. That is a conclusion.
So it's a moment of conclusion before going on to do more.
Came through so clearly.
Thank you.
Really.
Thank you.
And was that, did you use the neologism hauntology in there?
Yeah.
I love that.
Yeah.
Hauntology. Yeah. You know, like, foreboded. That's like, you know, that's interesting. And I think, you know, as we've been having this conversation about rhyming and music and other things, I was really listening for the music of the language there. And it was just extraordinary. Honestly, and variable in this way that, you know, we were talking earlier about sort of a predictability, but there's nothing like that. And so I can appreciate the gestures you're making with words and the arrangement. It's not, obviously not haphazard and a potent trip.
Thanks.
To go on. And I hope listeners out there will, also, you know, get into that. I should have already said about a half an hour ago that this is Poet Radio, and I'm with Ted Pearson here in the WGXC's Hudson studio on April 2024, and a great readings. And thanks so much for putting so much thought into, preparing, getting manuscripts. I mean, as usual, I just ask people to bring work that they want to read, but it's this very considerate selection.
Thank you.
I mean, I don't know what logic you were using. It doesn't matter.
I never do either until it shows up.
Right, know? Right.
Yeah. But thank you so much, Chris. It's been a pleasure.
Totally, totally. Yeah.
And it's great to reconnect. So,
any thoughts about National Poetry Month?
No.
No?
I don't really believe in the concept of nations.
Yeah, I hear you. I hear you. But I felt like, I should acknowledge
But if we're going to celebrate it, I'm happy to celebrate it with you in our little basement enclave.
Yes, that's where we are. Well, everyone, you are in tune to WGXC 90.7 FM, Acre Catskill, Hudson. This is Poet Radio. Stay tuned to Radio for Open Ears. Thank you very much.